From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are a couple of hearty perennials here, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor with National Journal, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. And here are the issues. President Obama has called on world leaders to join the United States in fighting the ISIS, or Islamic State terrorists, in Iraq and Syria, Russian aggression in Ukraine, and the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. But the air assaults on ISIS have prompted fears they are inadvertently aiding embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And at the United Nations, a climate change summit was held without the leaders of China and India in attendance, though both countries have declined to join global efforts to curb carbon emissions. All right. Well, President Obama had quite a speech at the UN. You know, one of the criticisms of President Obama, particularly from conservatives and Republicans, is that he hasn't shown strong leadership internationally. And yet this seemed to be a pretty good example of it. You remember what he said a few weeks ago and was jumped on for this? He said, well, he didn't have a strategy. Now, he does have a strategy. Even Charles Krauthammer, the columnist in The Washington Post, who's been about as critical of Obama as anyone in the media, said it's a workable strategy. Stephen, what do you think?
Right. You know, we've come in basically the space of a month from that moment where, he said, I've got no strategy to take on the Islamic State in Syria, to this sort of very strident, spare, vehement speech about the need to crack down on what he called networks of death, Islamic jihadists, who he said were in danger of thrusting the world into a new heart of darkness. So I think it's correct. It reminded me a little bit of the speech the president gave when he picked up his premature Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. He showed up in Oslo and actually gave a speech on sometimes there is a need to wage war against evil, against sort of organized thuggery in the world. He didn't really follow.
I remember that speech. Right. I don't think of myself as a warmonger, but
it was a fine speech. Yeah. But I think it's difficult to argue that he actually followed through on it. There's been a persistent criticism of the president and his foreign policy is that it's been too reliant on rhetoric and not enough on action. But I think as someone who is skeptical about this whole idea of putting together a coalition to battle Islamic State, I think we at least have to give the president credit. He's corralled a large number of Arab states to take airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. A number of European states are now coming on board, sending fighter aircraft to sort of patrol the skies over Iraq. So I think what it shows is that the United States does still have, when it decides to lead, the ability to build these coalitions. And even this president, who, as you say, many critics say has been indecisive on the world stage, can do it too when a clear strategy is elucidated. The question is it going to work? That's another question entirely.
Well, you know, normally in Washington, even though the president has said the strategy will take years, you know, those of us in journalism like to declare, you know, after about 3 or 4 days, well, has it worked or not? Tom, that's not my question, but just the broader question about Obama and American leadership.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Fred, what a difference a year makes. A year ago, at this very time, president, as presidents always do, go up to New York to address the UN General Assembly. And that speech a year ago, as I recall, was a couple of weeks after he had what some critics called wimped out after first drawing a line in the sand about Syria, red line, he called it. And then I think that speech a year ago was a couple of weeks after he had called off his plan for airstrikes against the Assad regime in Syria. His response was unenthusiastic. You had a lot of foreign leaders and their U.S. ambassadors talking about the uncertain trumpet of American leadership, and that seems to be a long time ago now. And I think the president is doing what he has to do. I agree with Stephen, and it's going to take longer, I think, than even his closest supporters believe. But I think for the moment, at least, he is doing something. And as I've said before, I think what has really helped Obama's ability to put together an international coalition is the gruesome quality of some of these beheadings and crucifixions and Now, a summary execution of some human rights lawyer in Iraq by firing squad. I think all these things may have helped the Islamic State's recruiting, but I think they have horrified the world and has made it easier to help in dealing with this. I guess I'm go out on a limb here and predict that the phrase network of death is going to be right up there with George W. Bush's axis of evil line several years ago.
A good line. I want to read another part of his speech because I thought it was an unusually good one. And the president said, this is again at the United Nations, resolutions alone will not be enough. Promises on paper cannot keep us safe. Lofty rhetoric and good intentions will not stop a single terrorist attack. The words spoken here today must be matched and translated into action. For if there was ever a challenge in our interconnected world that could not be met by one nation alone, it is this: terrorists crossing the border to unleash terrible violence. That was pretty good, too, don't you think, Stephen? And what about these countries joining in? You have a pretty good collection of countries so far, Arab countries, Middle Eastern countries, some European countries. I know Prime Minister Cameron in the UK was a little unsure at first, but now he seems to be on board.
Right. It looks like the British are going to join in airstrikes in Iraq, although the opposition Labour Party there in London, although it's praised the US strikes in Syria, says that a UN Security Council resolution would be needed before the UK could strike Syria for international legal reasons. The problem with that is that that's never going to happen. So it's kind of a slightly strange position.
Why can it never happen?
Because Russia or presumably China will veto that in the United Nations. The idea of there's always this question for China, particularly of member states intervening in other states' affairs, which China always blocks in the UN, and it likely Vladimir Putin would, you know, find a way to create some mischief on the part of Russia on that issue too. Actually, one thing I found quite interesting is you've seen states like the Netherlands, France, Denmark now, the UK. There seems to be a lot more resolve in Europe to take on this challenge than there is to take on Russia over its you know, actions in Ukraine and over sanctions. And I think it
Well, one of the reasons is the European countries, in fact, no other country, very few countries have economic relations with ISIS.
Right.
They have a lot with Russia.
Exactly, exactly. And that's one of the reasons. The other one is there's, you know, if you look at the politics in Europe right now, there's a lot of concern about the idea of these Western fighters coming back. There was already an attack by an Islamic State-affiliated terrorist in Brussels on a synagogue. I think it was earlier this year or last year. So that the fact that these Western-educated, brought-up Islamic fighters could come back into those societies is really concentrating the minds of governments. So that's one of the reasons why the Europeans have actually been quite proactive in joining this U.S. coalition.
Well, you know, Tom, I was surprised to read that there are 100, the estimate is 100 Americans who have joined ISIS and are fighting it.
Right, and have American passports, and if now I believe U.S. intelligence has identified some of them, we know who they are, but not all of them. And the great fear is that some of these Americans, the same is true for other Western citizens, will come home and export their terror. I think that's the thing that worries the United States government most of all right now.
Well, let me ask you about this. Much has been made by President Obama and others of this Syrian force that will be trained in Saudi Arabia, I believe, by American trainers, military trainers. And yet, I ask this, why the big deal? Because it'll take a year to train them, and then there'll only be 5,000 of them. I mean, they will be boots on the ground, but hardly a substitute for American boots on the ground.
Well, that's right. I mean, and the same is true for the Iraqi army, which seems like every other week or so, there's some new debacle where ISIS forces have beaten them somewhere or Iraqi military units disband. It's going to take a long time. There are more numbers. The Iraqi military is much larger than 5,000 moderate Syrian forces who are going to be trained in Saudi Arabia. But you need a lot of boots on the ground in Iraq, and then you're going to need more than 5,000. And I suspect there'll be a handful of thousand American soldiers on the ground in Syria before it's all over, maybe 1,500 or 2,000, because you've got to have spotters and air traffic controllers, and you've got to have some logistical support in there. But I think the president was adamant about that. That won't happen, because I think President Assad welcomes the Western attacks on ISIS, but at some point he might not continue to be totally docile about Western presence in his country.
Yeah, we're going to get to this whole Syria, this trade-off by going after ISIS, whether that's happening, helping the Assad regime there. But let's go back to another question is the idea is to train another Sunni force, and the Sunnis, of course, are the minority in Iraq, but to train a brigade or a battalion or some size force to help fight the ISIS terrorists. And so far, it was only a few days ago that ISIS met in Anbar province in Iraq, the Iraqi army, and one easily killed a few hundred of them and drove the others away. And there was no Sunni brigade. ISIS is mainly made up of Sunni Muslims. And yet there was no Sunni force there yet. I wonder, remember, there was one organized back in 2007 that fought against the Al-Qaeda terrorists, and these new terrorists are affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And yet, I just wonder whether this the Sunnis will join in here.
Right. That was the key factor in the surge, General Petraeus' surge in Iraq, which turned around the Iraq war back at the end of the Bush presidency. And, you know, let's not put too fine a point of it. One of the reasons that worked was because the U.S. was giving these guys money to change sides. It was financing them. It was helping them in their cities. It's unclear that is going on at this point. Perhaps it's something that the new Iraqi prime minister who met the president in New York this week might look into. I know that the U.S. is very keen to sort of get these Sunni tribes involved again. But it does point to a problem that the strategy, which we're praising, is going to come up against soon. There's going to be a dearth of targets for planes to attack, IS vehicles and fuel dumps and ammo dumps. And the Islamic State still controls a lot of towns and cities in Iraq. And, you know, the only way you can get people out of towns and cities is by having forces on the ground go and get them out. And at this point, it doesn't seem that the Iraqi forces are capable of that. We have the same problem in Syria. When the targets dry up, when ISIS takes to the cities, there's no ground force. I mean, this force we're talking about in Saudi Arabia is going to take 2 years to be trained. So that's why people are saying this is going to take a long time, because, you know, there's no one to fill the vacuum right now if the U.S. airstrikes are decisive in Syria.
There's some people at the Pentagon and the American military who believe that without a substantial number, not 100,000, but a substantial number of American combat troops fighting with the Iraqi army, without them there, the Iraqi army will remain in a state of collapse almost.
One of those, Fred, is Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, a Republican who was the Secretary of Defense for both President Bush and later President Obama, highly regarded, who has said President puts himself in a box when he says they're not going to be American combat troops on the ground. You won't be able to do this without some, you know, not an army, but some. As I said, I think there'll be a handful of thousand in Syria, but I think if the Obama administration is serious, and I think they are, they're gonna need tens of thousands of American troops back in Iraq.
Well, maybe the president, well, that will take a sales job by the president, but people respond to American presidents when they lead boldly. One final question about this, and after the break we'll get to Syria, but and that is Turkey. Turkey is headed by a man who the president, Erdogan, who the president says is one of his closest of foreign leaders to him, and he talked to him on the phone a couple days ago, and yet Turkey has been hands-off in this. Turkey's a member of NATO with all the European countries and the U.S. and Canada. What do you think, Stephen? Can Obama talk Erdogan into getting the Turks involved? And they're strategically located, for sure.
Right. I think there's been some signs in the last couple of days that the Turks may be shifting. They had about several dozen or more diplomats who were held hostage by ISIS forces. They managed to extricate those hostages about a week ago. And so, as you said, the president spoke to Erdogan on his way home from New York. Erdogan met Vice President Joe Biden, mm-hmm. With whom he has history going back a number of years. And it was significant, I think, that this week Erdogan appeared to at least open the door to logistical and military support for allied air operations, which perhaps could involve, you know, U.S. forces and allied forces flying from NATO bases in Turkey. So it seems to me that, you know, a lot of these countries have come off the fence a little bit. The administration has done a good sales job. It's got people like the Saudis involved, the Gulf states. It seems like choices are crystallizing a little bit in the Middle East, and governments are having to make a choice, basically. And it seems to me, at least, that the Turks are beginning to sort of move towards a more active role.
Tom, the pressure is certainly on the Turks, and certainly Erdogan has not gotten this kind of pressure from President Obama before.
He is. I think Turkey ultimately will have to do something. They're just too big a player. If they're not there, it'll be noticed, and it'll hurt Turkey. So I think sooner or later, even if it's, I think they're going to step into the fight gingerly, but mm-hmm. I think they will join the coalition.
Am I wrong in thinking that the oil that has helped finance ISIS goes, a lot of it goes through Turkey? Is that correct?
Right, yeah. And Turkey and various other countries, yeah. And you've actually interestingly seen the U.S. Start to bomb some of these oil refineries mm-hmm. in Syria that ISIS have been using, and there are even reports that the Islamic State group has actually stopped pumping oil to try and avoid, you know, losing this resource, mm-hmm. which has basically helped finance their march mm-hmm. through Syria and Iraq.
Well, that is a gain. I guess you can do that by air power. Other things, Stephen, as you noted, you can't. But that is one. Okay, we'll have more in just a minute, and we'll talk about Syria in particular. But first, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today on the show are Stephen Collinson of AFP, Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Well, there's been a lot written in the American press, at any rate, in the last couple of days about this question, and I'll start with you, Stephen, whether the attacks, ISIS, the enemy in Iraq, is also the enemy of the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad. And the thought is that, you know, that this is, by attacking ISIS, it's actually helping Assad triumph in his civil war. It seems to me you can't get around that at the moment. I mean, lots of countries like the UK are not bombing in Syria, but the US is. What about this whole problem?
Right. And, you know, whether you like it or not, the US has effectively picked sides now mm. by going into this civil war. Mm. And the propaganda meisters in Damascus have been making great cause of this, that, you know, saying stuff like, we're in the trenches with the US, we're fighting terrorists. And sooner or later, this complication or contradiction is going to come back to haunt this strategy because, like I said, there are no forces, the rebel forces are not constituted enough to go and fill any vacuum that the airstrikes create. You saw this week, interestingly, that the first U.S. strikes in Syria didn't just go after IS, they went after this group called Khorasan or mm-hmm. al-Nusra or whatever you want to call it. That actually angered some of the rebel forces that the U.S. is trying to co-opt to go and take on Islamic State, because al-Nusra in some manifestations was allied with some sectors of the rebel force. So that's just one indication of mm-hmm. the massive complications in this. You're basically talking about a country that's disintegrated into factions, and it's, you know, we know the record of the US and the outside world in trying to create outcomes in the Middle East. It's not very good, and sooner or later this is going to, you know, be an issue.
Well, it's fast becoming one, Tom, that's for sure.
Yeah,
what about it?
But I mean, I think the U.S. has no choice, and it was a well-known British prime minister in the 19th century. Actually, he was prime minister twice, Lord Palmerston, who uttered the famous phrase, "Nations have no permanent friends or permanent enemies, they have permanent interests." And at the moment, the United States government has made a determination that while they clearly are holding their nose about it, they are embarking on a policy that has President Assad smiling, because mm-hmm. ISIS wants to topple him. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the U.S., as President Obama likes to say, it's become a catchphrase, he intends to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS, up to a certain extent, to a large extent, that helps Assad consolidate his power.
Well, Tom, I congratulate you. I've been doing this show for many years, and this is the first time I have heard Lord Palmerston quoted. It was very fitting, no question about it, but I just wanted to note the first here, that's for sure. Well, what's the way out of this, Stephen? What does the U.S. do? I mean, they can't just allow ISIS to retreat. I mean, even if they drove them out of Iraq, they would be a huge force and cover, hold a lot of land in Syria. They'd still be this terrorist force in the Middle East.
Right. I don't think there really is a way out of it. The U.S. used to talk about how it triumphed over al-Qaeda in mm-hmm. Afghanistan and Iraq and various other places, mm-hmm. and now we have a new manifestation of, you know, jihadism. One way I think this is changing U.S. foreign policy is, you know, during the period of the Arab Spring, the U.S. was very interested in this whole idea of democracy, the idea that for the last 50 years, the West has kind of embraced despots around the Middle East. And in the end, these people who oppressed their people, it turned out that it wasn't in U.S. interest. Well, I think we might be seeing a change of that now. The president met al-Sisi, the president of Egypt, mm-hmm. in the U.N. He's trying to sort of reconstitute his relationship with another strongman, Erdogan, who's mm-hmm. increasingly powerful. He has kind of improved his relations with the Saudis, have been very critical mm-hmm. of U.S. foreign policy in the post-Arab Spring area. So, you know, to Tom's point, I think we might be seeing a period when United States dictates its foreign policy again, and its whole attitude to human rights and democratization in the Middle East becomes less important than the idea of stability. And we've gone through a period of disruption, and it seems to be that they're solidifying around these strongmen again.
Well, it is true, Tom. If you limit yourself to only talking to democratic leaders in the Middle East of the Thomas Jefferson variety, you're not going to be talking to many people.
Right.
But anyway, I want to move on to the climate change summit, also at the United Nations, where the president, who gave, how many speeches did he give there? Three, anyway.
Three, for sure.
And then talked to, there were many talking points that he gave after meeting with many of the world leaders. But this one, it seems to me that if you're talking about global efforts to curb global warming, and Chinese and Indian leaders aren't there, you're not going to make much progress.
That's right. And as long as, especially the Indians, I think, who are now the third biggest carbon polluter mm-hmm. in the world after the United States and China, mm-hmm. Kind of almost belligerently saying, no, we're not going to toughen mm-hmm. our standards. And the Chinese are obviously impervious to this. It is a problem. It's a growing problem. There will be eternal debate, perpetual debate on what has come to be known as the science, whether the science mm-hmm. is legitimate, is it, or whether it is just politically motivated. But this
I don't think the Chinese and the Indians care about that.
They don't care about it at all. They care about the economic development.
Sure.
But it's for real. I know I was on a cruise ship a couple of years ago that went to Antarctica, and we would pass these giant icebergs, and then we'd pass these smaller icebergs filled with hundreds of penguins. And the guides on the ship would say, 5 years ago, you would never see small icebergs laden with penguins that have broken off and are this far into not shipping lanes, mm-hmm. but into ocean lanes. And they say it's because of global warming, and it's undeniable. Well, we'll see, but you're right. Mm-hmm. The Chinese and the Indians are not interested in the science, even if the science were indisputable.
Well, the Chinese and the Indians do have a case against the U.S. They say, look, the United States have industrialized and certainly emitted a lot of carbon into the air for decades and decades and became this great economic powerhouse, and they're trying to do the same thing. But the U.S. and others who worry about global warming don't want to let them do it because they don't want to let them emit a lot of carbon.
Right. I mean, it's a fair argument, and yeah. it's a difficult one to counter. I think the administration believes that there may be at least an opening with the Chinese. There have been several sort of accords on things like the chemicals that are in refrigerators with the Chinese to sort of phase out certain harmful global warming chemicals. And the issue of environmentalism in China is actually quite an interesting one. There is even in a society as closed and as controlled as China, the air quality is an issue. You hear people that go and visit Beijing or go and live at Beijing mm-hmm. say that it's absolutely appalling, the mm-hmm. quality of the air. So environmental and the pace of development in China has been so quick that the environment has been basically ignored. So it is a big issue in China. The Indians, we're going to see next week or in the coming few days, Indian Prime Minister Modi is going to visit mm-hmm. the White House and see the president, be the first meeting between them, and global warming is going to be a key issue. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. has already sort of crossed swords with Modi on a big WTO trade deal, which he's not willing to implement. And I don't think that he's going to be particularly more open to the president's arguments on global warming either.
Well, the Indian leader, you know, the president said in his speech at the UN, so the climate is changing faster than our efforts to address it. Well, in fact, there hasn't been any further global warming in the past 17 years. Now, I don't know whether the Indian leader will want to cite that to the president, but it is true.
Well, and there is some scientific mm-hmm. evidence that the ozone layer is doing a little better
yep.
as these
mm-hmm.
things go. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was talking about the science. I mean, mm-hmm. you can make a case pro and in certain cases con against the science, but I think you're right. The Indians are not going to be this will be a hard sell for President Obama.
I just have a feeling, since the American press is one someone we know who worked in the White House, Tom, once told me, the American press can only keep one idea in their ID at the same time, and when the Indian leader is here, they're going to ask him about global warming and ignore everything else.
Yeah, they won't be talking about Kashmir. It'll be about the ozone layer.
Indeed. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.